Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Israel is planning a military takeover of Gaza, but not forever, says the prime minister.
We want to hand it over to Arab forces that will govern it properly without threatening us and giving Gazans a good life.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, what we know about Israel's plans and reactions to them. Also ahead, a new administration in the U.S. means new policy toward Africa.
It's become much more pragmatic with trade, not aid, as the cornerstone.
India imposes a book ban in Kashmir.
This is part of a multifaceted targeting of dissent.
And sea creatures, let me tell you, they are weird.
Eventually their arms sort of fall off and walk away from their body.
Yep, today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. The will he, won't he wait is over. Israel's prime minister today announced that Israel plans to occupy the entire Gaza Strip. In a Fox News interview, Benjamin Netanyahu said the goal is to free Gaza from Hamas.
We don't want to keep it. We don't want to be there as a governing body. We want to hand it over to Arab forces that will govern it properly without threatening us and giving Gazans a good life.
Netanyahu also blamed Hamas for the starvation crisis in Gaza, saying Hamas wants civilian casualties. The World's Matthew Bell follows news in the region. Matthew, the Israeli army essentially already controls the Gaza Strip. What would be different with this announcement?
The military controls about 75% of the territory of Gaza. That means around 2 million Palestinians are squeezed into the remaining 25%. But that 25% includes parts of the center of the Gaza Strip and then parts of Gaza City in the north. I talked with Michael Koplow today about this. He's the chief policy officer at the Israel Policy Forum. And he says Netanyahu is now ready to order the Israeli military to move into that remaining territory, that 25%, and then hold on to it.
Well, Netanyahu today is saying that what he ultimately wants is for Israel, once it has done this, to then turn over Gaza to some sort of international force or international coalition. There is zero evidence that that's going to materialize. And so what this means is the IDF occupying Gaza and administering it akin to the way that the IDF has a military occupation and administration inside of the West Bank.
What we haven't seen, Carolyn, really is, you know, public statements or any sign that Arab governments are ready and willing to put together an Arab force to govern Gaza. And this is a big, complicated operation that there doesn't seem to be a plan there right now for it.
So if the idea of an Arab force administering Gaza is basically unacceptable to Arab nations, that does not sound like a viable long-term strategy. What then is the Israeli plan for Gaza in the longer term after this acute phase of the war is over?
This is something Benjamin Netanyahu has been reluctant to talk about since the start of the war. Remember, the Biden administration was calling for the U.S.-backed Palestinian Authority very early on to take over in Gaza eventually. But Netanyahu rejected that idea. The United Nations and many U.N. member states around the world want to get back to the plan for a two-state solution, but Netanyahu's government is against that too. This prime minister has said that the war aims are to free the hostages, to defeat Hamas, and make sure Hamas doesn't regain control in Gaza. But he's never really articulated anything like a detailed vision for the long-term future of the Gaza Strip.
So this all, of course, began after the October 7th Hamas attack in 2023. That is almost 2 years ago now. How much support does Netanyahu have right now for occupying Gaza?
His war cabinet is fully behind him. Far-right members of his governing coalition have actually been calling for this since the start of the war, so they support it. This prime minister still has his supporters in the Israeli public, but also there's a big political opposition. Many Israeli voters say that it's time for this war to end. There have been enormous anti-war demonstrations in Israel. They're happening almost every day. And Carolyn, maybe most importantly, the head of the Israel Defense Forces has actually been pushing back against this idea of reoccupying Gaza. Here's what Michael Koplow had to say about that.
Eyal Zamir, the chief of staff, does not want to do this, does not think it's a good idea. There have been reports of serious friction between Zamir and Netanyahu, where Zamir has presented the IDF's plans for a next phase in Gaza, and Netanyahu has ordered him to come back in a couple of days with a plan to conquer and occupy all of Gaza.
Something to watch here, I think, Carolyn, is what the IDF chief of staff does next. He was appointed early this year by the Netanyahu government because actually there was friction between Netanyahu and the last chief of staff. Well, now there's speculation that Zamir could even decide to resign in protest of this Gaza occupation plan. And in the meantime, these big protests are continuing in Israel, and they're being led by the relatives of the 20 or so living hostages that are still thought to be held inside the Gaza Strip.
That's The World's Matthew Bell reporting on the announcement today that Israel plans to occupy the entire Gaza Strip. Find more of our coverage on the war in Gaza at theworld.org.
Robo-taxis are coming to Europe. The American ride-hailing app Lyft has announced plans to put self-driving taxis on the roads in Germany and the UK starting next year. They're doing it with the help of a tech company from China. The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, is following the story. First of all, Jeremy, remind us what we mean when we say robo-taxi.
Well, in a sense, they're exactly what they sound like. Robot taxis that can take you wherever you want to go with no driver needed. But to get into the nit and grit a little bit, they're basically traditional cars that you'd hire on a ride-hailing app like Lyft or Uber. But rather than having the driver that you'd rate and tip, instead they're equipped with artificial intelligence that analyzes the road around them with cameras and sensors to see other cars and pedestrians, and then uses navigation software to get you to your destination.
Gotcha. Okay, so what do you know, what can you tell us about this new partnership with a company from China to bring robo-taxis to Europe?
Well, it was just announced this week, and the two players here are Lyft, an American app, and Baidu, which is essentially the Google of China. Lyft will be the platform that people can use to order a car like you usually would. And then Baidu, which started as a search engine but has been operating self-driving cars in China for half a decade now, they will provide the cars. They're starting out small here, just the UK and Germany next year, as you mentioned, pending regulatory approval. But then in the years ahead, Marco, the companies say they plan to have a fleet of thousands of robo-taxis across Europe. And that could have huge implications for the global race to dominate this emerging robo-taxi market.
Yeah, so tell us more about that. Why is this being seen as such a big deal?
Because when it comes to robo-taxis and self-driving technology in general, there are basically two poles, China and the U.S. And because of escalating diplomatic and trade tensions, in many ways, those two poles are kind of stuck in place. You know, you're not going to see Chinese robo-taxis on the street in the U.S., and you're not going to see American robo-taxis anywhere in China. But then there are huge markets in between the two of them. As I've already been reporting this year, the Middle East has kind of become a testing ground, especially countries like the UAE, where regulation is overall fairly lax, and also pristine roads and a lack of snow and rain can make it easier for self-driving cars to navigate safely. That's why you've seen Uber, Lyft's biggest ride-hailing competitor, announce its own partnerships with Chinese firms like Pony AI and WeRide to deploy robo-taxis there. Now, Europe is kind of the next frontier here. They don't have self-driving taxis yet. And so Lyft and Baidu jumping in together, these will be the first autonomous vehicles on the continent, and that has the potential to upend the robo-taxi industry.
Yes, so you mentioned the kind of easy regulations that companies might experience in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. In Europe, though, that's not the case when it comes to regulation, right?
Yeah, that's also where things get interesting here. Part of the reason I assume Lyft went with Baidu is that their autonomous vehicles are relatively cheap and they're already being used across China. But the big question is whether their vehicles will work and work well in Europe. So the cars involved in this deal, Baidu's Apollo RT6, as they're called, they've been deployed in China since 2022, but they are big. They're almost like minivans. Robotaxis like those work in China. But if you know European streets and the cars that usually drive on them, that could be a problem. And then there's the question of regulation and data. Europe, on the whole, tends to have a strong regulatory framework for both safety and data security. So even if this works out in the UK and Germany next year, the rest of the continent is another question.
Yeah, and how do you imagine all of this playing out, say, a year or two down the road?
There's a lot up in the air, especially when you consider the broader context of driverless cars. There's so much investment right now, and it's clear when you look at China's Baidu and also Waymo here in the U.S., you know, these are two tech companies who've decided that autonomous vehicles are part of their future. But I think there are two big questions that you still have to consider. The first is how well and how safely they'll actually work on a large scale, and also whether any single player will emerge as the dominant force here. For how well they'll work, that's kind of a wait and see situation. But for the dominant force question, I think we're already starting to get some answers, and this new partnership gives some of those answers. You know, as I mentioned, Waymo is trying to make inroads both in the US and other parts of the world. Tesla has big plans too, but the company's really struggling with sales on the international stage. And if you look at what Lyft is doing in Europe now and what Uber has been doing in other parts of the world, partnering with Chinese firms, the writing is kind of on the wall. They're not waiting around for American robo-taxis. And if driverless cars do end up being a big part of how we get around in the future, it looks like China is going to play a central role.
The World Transportation Correspondent Jeremy Siegel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Every now and then, a new sport makes it into the Olympics. Think sport climbing, breaking, rugby sevens. But before any of those sports were in the Olympics, they proved their worth in a different global competition. The world's Bianca Hillier explains.
At a performance in Chengdu, China today, hundreds of dancers wowed crowds with choreographed routines and costumes. It was the precursor to the main event, the athletes' parade.
Afghanistan!
Afghanistan have the honor of leading the way in this athletes' parade.
Over 100 groups marched onto the stage in country-specific attire, with flag bearers at the helm. Despite the pomp and circumstance, this is not the Olympics. It's the opening ceremony of what's called the World Games. They're held every 4 years in cities across the globe.
Last, the host nation, the People's Republic of China.
China is hosting more than 4,000 international athletes at this year's event. Some of them compete in sports you'll likely have heard of, like baseball, American football, and karate. But what the World Games are really about are the obscure sports you probably have not heard of.
Speedy, exciting, and highly skilled, drone racing is one of the fastest-growing air sports in the world today.
Drone racing. Athletes steer drones through gates and around barriers. France's Kylian Rousseau hopes to defend his gold medal. Then there's parkour. Participants make their way through an obstacle course, showing off their styles with acrobatics along the way. And then there's life-saving. Historically, Italians win this one with their near-perfect rescue techniques. One new sport at this year's World Games is called motosurf. It's literally described as Mario Kart, but on water.
It's a little wobble over the line, but going straight into the waves at that point, that makes that first turn tricky.
Athletes race on electric surfboards, going around buoys before zooming to the finish line. Honestly, it looks like a lot of fun. Most of these disciplines, of course, have not yet reached the mainstream upper echelons of international competition. But being part of the World Games is a step toward that ultimate spotlight. That's what happened with breaking, for example.
Yes.
unbelievable.
This year, disc golf athletes hope to prove why they deserve a spot at the 2032 Olympics in Brisbane, Australia. The World Games run from today until August 17th, and you can watch all the action for free at theworldgames.org. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Coming up, barbecue. It's more than just an American pastime. We'll serve up the popular food tradition on a global plate next. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Many of us amateurs learn to grill in our backyards. For professionals, though, there's a three-year training program soon to be on offer in China at the newly formed Barbecue Research Institute. The collaboration between a Chinese university and a regional barbecue association aims to train 1,000 grill masters over the next 3 years. Skewered grilled meat is a hugely popular street food in China.
As it is in many places, barbecue is as diverse as it is universal. That is made very clear in a new cookbook, Barbecue, Smoked and Grilled Recipes from Across the Globe. Chef Hugh Mangum, based in Los Angeles, compiled the recipes and spoke with me earlier this summer.
What defines barbecue to me, in the truest sense that I've now kind of come to love and learn, is what is the celebratory food that is cooked over live fire, via smoke or coal or direct heat, that is celebratory in, you know, people's rituals. It's a celebration food, whether it's a family of four, whether it's a gathering of 40. All food should be cooked from the heart, in my opinion. You know, that's the best food. But I do believe that barbecue, in its truest sense, is just a gathering, nurturous food that is cooked, you know, using and utilizing fire.
I love that celebratory aspect that you bring in there. Where does the word barbecue come from?
The word barbacoa is where barbecue is derived from, which, you know, we've, I hate to say co-opted, but, you know, we've used that in the U.S. to make it our national dish, which
it's a Spanish word, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it most definitely is our food here, you know, barbecue, as we call it. But barbacoa, you know, comes from Spanish cooking and cuisine, and it's been around for hundreds of years.
And what does it mean literally, barbacoa?
The truest sense of barbacoa is, you know, generally meat that is cooked in the ground using fire and or coals.
Got it. So in the U.S., barbecue gets traced back to slavery. African Americans, as I understand it, use these cooking techniques to prepare the cuts of meat they could get access to. Is that a central global narrative, kind of people living under terrible conditions and through that deprivation had to figure out how to make do with what they had access to taste good?
Yeah. I mean, as a general rule, yes. It was the offcuts. It was the heads, the necks, the legs, you know, the hams, everything that took longer to cook and break down because of intermuscular structure was tended to be kind of, you know, cast away. They used ingenuity to figure out how to cook those cuts to get the best out of them.
Aside from the U.S., where do we see that barbecue story kind of coming alive?
There's versions of it in Mexico, all over the Czech Republic, all of those kind of Eastern Bloc places as well. Then you get into Southeast Asia, and there's versions of cooking, but it's more high heat. But it's, you know, again, it's all of the things that were kind of cast away initially and then cooked that way.
Well, I mean, this is a perfect moment to bring in Mei Chow, a chef in Hong Kong and contributor to this book. Hi, Mei. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So I'll ask you in a second about what you brought specifically to this cookbook that we've been talking about with Hugh. But what are your go-to components for a Hong Kong barbecue?
Hong Kong barbecue, there's two types. So what we're most renowned for, because we're in the southern part of China, is a huge part of Cantonese cuisine is roasted meats. Super crispy skin pork belly. We do a char siu, which is actually a roasted pork shoulder with a glazed honey with a sweet and savory marinade. And also we roast duck and goose, and it's super common, and you'll see it on the streets where we'll have it for lunch over rice. If it's in a fancy dinner, it'll be, you know, just a main course. For the one that I specifically chose, which is the char siu, is kind of like a Hong Kong icon. So if you ever come to Hong Kong, you must have it.
Yeah, so tell us more about char siu, because I have seen this on menus in pretty much every Chinese restaurant I've ever eaten at. But for purists, what is char siu really about?
So char siu, if you literally translate it from Cantonese, it literally means like to roast on a fork. And so our ovens are, these barbecue ovens are actually vertical ovens. And what we're able to do is we first marinate in a sweet and savory marinade. And always we have to pick a certain part of the pork that's soft, but also has great marbling, because we want juicy, kind of like that, you know, the succulent fattiness that's coming through. You want the fat. You don't want to have that fat is what makes or breaks it. So you marinate it. And what you do is like you skewer it into these long skewers and you hang it inside the oven.
The way you're describing it, I feel like I've never had it authentically here in the U.S. Have you ever eaten authentic char siu in the U.S., Mei Chow?
I have my love for, you know, Chinese diaspora food. And so, you know, I do my fair trade of orange chicken, you know, and char siu. I would have to say that, you know, if you really want the best, either use this recipe or come to Hong Kong.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, I got to say. Mei, I want to pick up on Hugh's point about barbecue being the celebratory food kind of event. When you throw a typical Hong Kong barbecue, what is the scene like? Is it at someone's home or do you typically go to a restaurant?
We typically go to restaurants because Chinese barbecue is actually quite technical. Like it's a huge drum that people barbecue. And so it's not, there's a different type of barbecue that we do friends, but I think my American friends don't understand because it's literally, it's a fork with two prongs. And that's a different type of barbecue over an open fire. And you can only ever skewer two chicken wings on it. And my friends don't understand why you would spend so much time,
barbecuing. And what do you tell them? What is your argument?
It's the romance of barbecue, of like all things Chinese. They like sitting around a fire and just chit-chatting. And it's strategic. You need to cook the easy-to-cook stuff first, like the sausages. And then you move on to the chicken wings. You never start with chicken wings. That's an amateur move.
Sorting out the real from the fake chefs.
Yeah. We take roasted meats really seriously. So I think especially in the roasted duck and the roasted goose category, we really have the masters who do it.
And something Mei just said that like resonates as well is like sitting around that fire. There's something so primal about what barbecue truly is in any iteration. There's something about gathering around a fire. That's how civilization started, essentially, once we figured out fire. And it's always been something we've sought out. And food is just the best, most celebratory vessel to do that with.
Well, it kind of feels like you're anticipating my next question, Hugh, because in Spain, you've got barbecued root vegetables. In Egypt, there's spiced fish that's barbecued. Aside from the fire, heat, and smoke, what is the common thread all other barbecue?
Yeah, so, you know, again, fire is the common thread. Celebration is the common thread, but also, you know, getting together. Generally, you never think about eating barbecue alone. It's something that you do with people. You go out to with people. It's shared food. Whether you're in Tokyo and going to get yakitori at an izakaya, or you're in Australia and having some snags, which, you know, are sausages or their version of sausage / hot dogs, it's always something that you're doing amongst people, friends, colleagues. I find it romantic and like it's just it's beautiful to me. It's just something that I've always kind of gravitated to.
Chef Hugh Mangum, thank you very much for coming in. And Chef Mei Chow, thank you for joining in from Hong Kong.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
The cookbook is Barbecue, Smoked and Grilled Recipes from Across the Globe.
More global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. You are listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. France is fighting the biggest wildfire the country has seen in 75 years. It's been going on for 2 days, and already flames have consumed a big chunk of the Aude region in southwestern France. Some of the causes are not surprising: high temperatures, lots of wind, dry conditions. But there's something else contributing to the fire's severity: a decades-old program to get vintners to stop making wine. The World's Jerry Haddon brings us that story from just across the border in Barcelona.
More than 2,000 firefighters are battling the rapidly advancing flames, going door to door where they can, trying to evacuate residents. Live on French TV, an emergency worker reaches one house with burning embers on its roof. "You've got to leave now," he orders an elderly couple. The man hesitates. His wife exhorts him to get a move on, but the man seems frozen, just standing near his front door. Smoke swirling everywhere. "Everything we worked for is in that house," the man says. "What do you expect me to do? I can't pretend it isn't happening." Finally, the man leaves with his wife. In a nearby village, an elderly woman refused to evacuate her place yesterday. She became this fire's first victim. Authorities are now evacuating thousands of people from summer campsites and residential areas as 40-mile-an-hour winds and a heat wave push the fire in several directions at once. "Given how fast the fire has been spreading," says French Fire Department spokesman Eric Brocardi, "you could say the Aude has basically been hit by an incendiary bomb." "Complicating things," Brocardi says, "is the difficult terrain and the dry vegetation everywhere. Dry vegetation everywhere, in part because of little rainfall over the last few years, but also because of a lake, a wine lake, that is. The lake refers to a huge amount of excess wine in France and a government program to reduce the number of vineyards." Franck Sayan is head of the Vintners Union in the Aude region. He says from the 1980s up until today, France has been paying vintners around $1,900 an acre to uproot their fields and plant something else. This as wine consumption in France drops. "The problem in the Aude," he says, "is that we hardly have any rain and terrible soil. We can't grow other crops. So the vintners have just abandoned their fields," he says, "and they become overgrown with bushes, grass, and brambles. All of it fuel for wildfires." Before the uprooting program began, he says, the region's thousands of wide-open vineyards acted as firebreaks, dividing up surrounding forests. Now, he says, fires can strike and reach anywhere. "Before, if you had your house, say, behind your vineyard, it was safe. Now, entire villages have seen their vineyards turn into overgrown thickets that burn easily, leaving them unprotected." Sayon says his union of some 3,000 vintners has been warning authorities for more than 20 years that abandoning winemaking would ultimately lead to bigger and faster fires. They're calling on the government to pay vintners, at least in the Aude region, to not rip their vines out. He says within the next 3 years, if the government doesn't reverse course, there will be no vineyards left around some towns. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Head over to theworld.org. You'll find our extensive coverage of weather and climate that draws the connections between events around the globe. That is at theworld.org. In the Mexican state of Chiapas, deep in the rainforest, an international team of archaeologists has found what they think are remnants of a Mayan settlement known as the Sacbalan, or the Land of the White Jaguar. It was the last stronghold for Mayan rebels resisting Spanish conquest.
Letters written by a Spanish friar describing his journeys to the settlement back in the 17th century are what gave archaeologists the clues they needed to locate the previously hidden site. A researcher at Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History used the details in those letters to zero in on a search area. Sacbalán resisted European rule for more than a century before falling to Spain in 1695.
In India, authorities have just announced a ban on 25 books in the disputed region of Kashmir. The government says the books promote, quote, false narratives and secessionism in the Muslim-majority territory. And now anyone in possession of the books could land in prison. Natasha Call is a professor at the University of Westminster in the UK.
This latest ban on books is not surprising. It is yet another step in the way in which the public sphere, civil society, and critical thinking is being targeted. These books cover a wide range of texts. So they range from popular books to books written by media personnel to academic books, and from books, again, on gender to books on mourning, to books on a conflict, violence, finding ways through conflict. It's really quite a diverse range of books. According to the media reportage on this, the formal reason that they've given for banning these books is that they excite secessionism.
Do all of the books, is it apparent, you know, how they would do that, or are some of them confusing why they would be banned?
As an academic, I would say that it is not clear at all in the absence of any evidence to any specific parts of texts or quotes within their context as to how they do this. In the absence of that, this simply amounts to an assertion.
And is this common in India? Are other books banned?
So it hasn't ever been as common as it has become in the last 10 years or so. So this is part of a multifaceted targeting of dissent and of seeking to have conformity and lack of critical questioning. In the past, what we've seen over the years is that typically you would have a vigilante group or some right-wing ideologue who would file cases in courts against texts saying that they are insulting feelings or that they are against Hindutva or that they are somehow problematic. And in some cases, those books would then be restricted or banned. We have also seen a very similar process when it comes to movies, where certain kinds of cultural texts and cinematic representations are promoted actively, whereas other movies about the past have sometimes been targeted by vigilante groups, or there have been people at cinemas protesting the showing and screening of those films. So there's a longer story to how textbooks, cinema, books, and other kinds of academic popular culture productions have been targeted. So there's a longer trend of this kind of thing happening, but this is quite explicit in that the books have been named and punishments have been stated.
So what happens if, you know, a bookstore or an individual has one of these titles?
That they're basically saying that the books can be forfeited under India's new criminal code of 2023. So that bans the works from circulation, possession, and access within the Himalayan region. And various elements of the code threaten prison terms of 3 years, 7 years, or even life for offenses relating to forfeit media, although no one has been jailed under them. So this is what the AP reports.
What does this book banning order say to you about the current situation in India?
The current book ban, I think, indicates that there is insecurity, first of all. It indicates that the regime feels threatened by the written word. This takes me back to the idea that regimes that feel threatened in this way are regimes that seek to silence dissent rather than respect democratic functioning. It's quite clear that this is part of a systematic pattern, including changes to textbooks, including revisionist rewriting of history, including targeting of academics. And within that context, this is yet another step that shows how the public sphere and people's voices are a threat to the regime, which is insecure and cannot substantively answer any of those things. As the philosopher Hannah Arendt said, within the public sphere, any kind of authoritarian, totalitarian move is always threatened by critical thinking and discussion. And this just shows us that a very pertinent example of how the written word can be such a challenge to a regime which doesn't want to be accountable.
Natasha Call is a professor at the University of Westminster in the UK.
The U.S. has been dramatically scaling back its military operations in Africa. Instead of deploying large numbers of troops or maintaining permanent bases, the Pentagon is now focused on targeted assistance and remote surveillance. Washington's partners in Africa are now required to lead their own security operations. Critics of the policy fear the shift could empower extremists. In fact, some say that's already happening. There's also concern that this also opens the door to growing Chinese and Russian influence on the continent. AFRICOM is the Pentagon's headquarters for military operations in Africa. It's based in Stuttgart, Germany. And we've got two key people from AFRICOM with us to discuss. Lieutenant General John Brennan is AFRICOM's deputy commander. Hello to you, sir.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And Ambassador Robert Scott is AFRICOM's deputy to the commander for civil and military engagement. Hello, Ambassador. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
General Brennan, plans for streamlining were announced in the spring. What's new about U.S. military strategy in Africa?
The administration has obviously changed, and with that, the policy has changed. So I think it's become much more pragmatic with trade, not aid, as the kind of cornerstone of it. From a security perspective, we're still preventing attacks against our homeland by counterterrorism operations across the continent with allies and partners. But the emphasis has been much more on competition with China, Russia, as well as empowering partners to pull their own weight and do the heavy lifting.
How would you describe the disadvantage that that brings?
Obviously, Africa is a huge place. It's very, very diverse in everything from terrain, culture, economic opportunities, et cetera. So it is a labor-intensive goal to try to stop these terrorist organizations from taking root. The mass of the problem requires others to contribute. So we're looking to shift and share burdens with allies and partners so that we can get greater effects with potentially less military assets. But as Ambassador Scott will tell you, the economic investment is definitely taken off on the continent, and prosperity breeds security and vice versa.
Well, Ambassador Scott, I mean, I think of the elimination of USAID and how that's undercut soft power tools like development aid, health programs, and climate resilience initiatives. Those tools have traditionally complemented U.S. military efforts in Africa. Now they're gone. Has that made your job harder?
Well, I think we're seeing a tool that is coming to the forefront right now is economic investment and kind of strategic investment. I'll give you two quick examples. General Brennan and I had a chance to travel to Namibia and Angola. In Angola, we were able to see the impact of the Lobito Corridor Initiative, where the U.S. is helping build a spur out of Zambia through the eastern DRC. That's a rail spur, and all the way down to Lobito, the port in southern Angola. We also learned that there's a $1 billion U.S. Export-Import Bank project for solar power in the south of the country. There's a U.S. company that just received a contract to build 180 bridges connecting the north and south, as well as the east and west in Angola. And there's a big project for grain silos. All of these things coming together are viewed by our Angolan partners as securing their prosperity and securing their country. I was just in Liberia, just got back yesterday, saw that a $1.8 billion deal was signed when President Trump met with President Boakai of Liberia. That is going to allow for the rehabilitation of a rail spur from Guinea to the port of Buchanan. U.S. companies involved, and they'll be able to extract primarily iron ore. Again, Liberia sees this as augmenting their security. And so we're seeing this increased activity as an important new and effective tool for strengthening our partnerships.
I mean, for sure, rail and solar are important investments, but there's a fundamental problem right now, it seems, and that is a lot of interest in African resources. And wherever you look, Niger with uranium, Burkina Faso with gold, Congo, obviously, with its heavy metals, that's in part what's animating both jihadists and, for sure, outside national and commercial interests. Won't citizens, as usual, get lost in the shuffle whether or not the U.S. military increases or decreases its engagement? General, what do you think?
You're right. The vast resources of Africa are an open market, and some of the partners and allies on the continent may or may not seek to invest with U.S. companies, or they may seek to invest with Chinese companies or Russian companies. But it's a different ballgame when you're dealing with a state-owned enterprise from China versus a private company from the United States. We've seen the debt traps that China sets for some of the allies on the continent that are unhelpful with their overall prosperity for their people.
As you know, there have been discussions of eliminating AFRICOM entirely, consolidating it into the European command. Ambassador, do you think there's some validity to these partners feeling abandoned?
What I'm seeing on the ground is a recognition that the primary focus for our partners is taking a look at their economies and trying to generate prosperity. I mean, ultimately, what security gets you is an ability to have a stable economy, which then allows your population to take advantage of its own resources.
And really the state, Department of State and DOD subsume some of aid's budget. So the money's still there. It's just different. So the Office of Strategic Capital, their budget doubled. The Development Finance Corporation, their budget has doubled. And so the investment is just a different type. It's commercial versus primarily health and med sectors. And I've talked to our partners, too. They were happy that, you know, we were funding all of their medical sector. They didn't have to because we did it for them. At the end of the day, they want private investment. They want factories. They want critical mineral enrichment on the continent in their country so that all their people can benefit from it.
And at the same time, when Chinese officials talk with African leaders, they point to U.S. military drawdowns as proof that Washington cannot be counted on in a crisis, especially in West Africa. I mean, they contrast that with the roads and schools and ports that they have built. Do you really believe the U.S. can overtake China on these moves? Ambassador, what do you think?
It's the choice of the people and the governments that are our partners. So we provide a choice. I think we, as a country, both in security and with our private companies, provide the best return on investment possible. And that's what we saw in Liberia. We're seeing in Angola. So it's not a question of forcing countries to make a choice. It's a question of providing them with information about the choice that we provide.
But what if that choice turns out for those governments? We'll go to Russia for help. I mean, Russia is using its military contractors and arms sales to step into the vacuum in places like Mali, Central African Republic, Niger, Burkina Faso. They offer protection in exchange for access to mineral-rich resources. I mean, how is the Pentagon going to confront that reality?
All the partners I've talked to prefer U.S. equipment training, having our trainers there over Russia, and China doesn't really do a lot in that sector. They also use suboptimal materials that fail, and that kind of ties into some corruption. So they provide materials at a lower cost because it's not what their partners are paying for. But at the end of the day, the Russians are trying to roll back the clock to the 1960s. So they use information operations. They don't have a lot of forces on the continent either, if you look at the actual numbers. But they do spend a lot of money on propaganda to try to make the West and us appear as colonizers when in fact, it's the Russians and the Chinese that are colonizing and taking advantage of the partners on the continent.
Ambassador Scott, are there long-term risks of the U.S. treating its military engagement in Africa as transactional rather than part of a sustained strategic partnership? Are you worried about that?
I view it and have viewed it as a sustained strategic partnership. When we meet with friends, we meet with people who are familiar with us. They know what we bring to the table. The thing to remember is they're signaling to us how they want to engage with us. As sovereign countries, they reach out and indicate their priorities. We match with them, and we are very upfront as well as far as what we can provide and what we are looking for out of the relationship as well. So we're meeting each other eye to eye and have for a long time. I think it's a positive thing.
Lieutenant General John Brennan, AFRICOM's Deputy Commander, and Ambassador Robert Scott, AFRICOM's Deputy to the Commander for Civil Military Engagement. Thank you both very much, gentlemen.
Likewise, thanks.
Appreciate it.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Sea stars, also known as starfish, are at home nearly everywhere on the planet, but their numbers along the North American West Coast have been decimated. The sunflower sea star in particular has lost 90% of its population. Scientists finally have a culprit. A bacteria has been killing them. Scientist Alyssa Gaiman was part of the team behind this discovery. The research was just published in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution this week. I asked her to give us some Starfish 101.
They're these amazing animals. They live on the bottom of the ocean floor. Most of them have five arms, but actually the sunflower star that we study starts with five when it's a baby and then just keeps popping out arms until it gets up to around 24 arms.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it really matters that these populations were decimated because the starfish is what's called a keystone species, which means it's really important for the rest of the ecosystem. Can you tell me about that and what happened when these things started disappearing?
So sunflower stars, they eat almost everything that lives on the bottom of the ocean. Like there's a bunch of different animals that have escape responses from them. Like sea urchins, which are these little spiky animals, run away from them, all at relatively slow speeds for our eyes, but they're running. And urchins, when they don't have something eating them, it turns out their populations just boom. And then those urchins eat kelp And so when we got so many more urchins than they used to be, we started to lose the kelp forests. Mm. And we didn't, in fact, know how important sunflower stars were to controlling the urchin populations until we lost them.
And then kelp forests, in turn, are like the nurseries for a bunch of other marine species, and they're also a big carbon sink, right?
Yeah, they also help sort of dissipate waves from storms. They're incredibly important ecosystems.
So when was it first noticed that these sea stars were succumbing to this mystery disease, and what did that look like?
Yeah, the first observations were in 2013, and what they saw were animals twisting their arms. So the sea stars normally sort of have their arms out straight, and they started to twist back around their body, and they start to get lesions. And actually, eventually, their arms sort of fall off and walk away from their body.
The arms walk away?
The arms walk away. The sea star walks away, too. It's really gruesome. And you know, if you're diving, you might actually see just a couple of arms, and then you'll see the rest of the sea star a few feet away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bit underwater apocalyptic.
Yeah, it's awful. And it's really stark, because these sea stars really, especially up and down the coast, on the West Coast, are just, they used to be everywhere. And so as you're watching them die, it looks different to be underwater when they're gone.
All right. So you have led this research that has discovered what is doing this to this species. Tell us how you discovered that this bacteria is causing this wasting disease.
Yeah, it was through careful experiments. So we started from a space where we just really had no idea what was causing this disease. And so we started with a sick animal, and we collected tissues. And in some cases, importantly, we collected their body fluid. So kind of like, it's similar to blood. And we did controlled exposures in the lab. And so what we found was incredibly clear. All of the ones we exposed to what we thought might have live pathogen in it, they all died. Or almost all of them died, really 95%. And the next question is, okay, what's in what we were exposing them to? And what we found was in those exposed animals, just tons of Vibrio pectinocyta. It would make up like 80% of what was in their body fluid, and none in the controls.
Hmm. A clear picture there that this is what was causing this wasting disease, which must be very gratifying as a scientist, but in and of itself does not help protect these animals. Are there steps that can be taken now to stop the spread of this bacteria?
There are. So there are people on the ground just immediately able to respond to this new piece of information. So we have folks who are trying to raise sea stars in the lab and successfully doing so. And with these new tools, maybe we can start to find individuals that are resistant to this pathogen and maybe raise those. We can also look for probiotics and maybe phages, which is a virus that attacks bacteria. And that can be used to help the sea star fight off this disease. We can also screen populations in the wild to see how much of Vibrio pectinocyta is out there and try and find places where there's very little, and maybe that's where we try and focus our recovery efforts. That's sort of just the beginning of things that we can do. There's a lot we can do now.
Are you hopeful now?
I am hopeful. I remain worried. One of the things that we're going to do in the future is start to look at how temperature relates with this disease. Hmm. And there is a lot of evidence that warm temperatures are associated with more disease in this system. But I'm really hopeful that we can take the steps that are necessary to help this species.
Alyssa Gaiman is a scientist at the Hakai Institute and the University of British Columbia.
We learned late yesterday that Latin pianist, bandleader, and composer Eddie Palmieri has died. Born in New York City in 1936, he, perhaps more than any other musician, marshaled the sounds coming out of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Colombia into a recognizable style that Americans know as salsa, and he brought that sound to the worlds of jazz and rock. He was one of the first musical guests we welcomed into our studios at The World.
That was in the cha-cha movement. We would be cha-cha-cha. Cha-cha-cha, ba-ba, And one of the orchestras that made it very, very popular was the charanga orchestras, like Orquesta Aragon in those years, Orquesta America.
In this 2004 conversation, Eddie Palmieri charmed us with a masterclass on rhythms like Son Montuno, Mambo, and Cha-Cha-Cha, and he told us he'd been listening mostly to classical music because it was a soothing antidote to the rest of his life, but also for the challenge. Classical composers, Palmieri told me, wrote music for technical ability, and he'd been developing a musical idea around a thought experiment.
The concept is if the great composers would have known of the African rhythms then, that's really what it's all about.
We end today's show with a moment I shared with Palmieri in the World Studios in 2004.
Give us a bit more of the elaboration of the classical with the Afro-Cuban, if you would. Just a bit more of how it evolves.
Well, it's a...
Eddie Palmieri died yesterday at his home in Hackensack, New Jersey.
The World comes to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Sharon G and Robert Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.